the state of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. This starts the January term of court for the South Dakota Supreme Court. And before we get started on arguments, I first of all want to welcome the newest member of the court this morning, Justice Scott Myron. Welcome,
Thank
Justice
you.
Myron. At this time, we're going to proceed with oral arguments on the case of the State of South Dakota versus Stephen Falkenberg. Raleigh Hansman appears on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Falkenberg, and Ms. Chelsea Winsel appears on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 20 minutes apiece for your initial arguments, and then Ms. Hansman, you will have a 10-minute rebuttal after the state finishes its argument. The orange light will come on at 2 minutes to give you a warning when you're at the end of coming up toward the end of your time. So with that, Ms. Hansman, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. Cut, chop, sever, amputate, decapitate, dismember. These are the words the state of South Dakota used consistently and repeatedly throughout the second-degree murder trial of Stephen Falkenberg. Words that by their very utterance elicit a visceral, emotional reaction in a listener, in a juror. Words that in this case disregarded the indisputable evidence and testimony that dismemberment was unrelated to the cause of death, happening days later after the body had been frozen and occurring in a separate jurisdiction. Facts admitted and acknowledged by the state of South Dakota, both pre-trial and during trial. Under the guise of concealment evidence, the state of South Dakota devoted 25% of its case in chief to the discussion and depiction of dismemberment. Stephen Falkenberg's second-degree murder conviction should be vacated and remanded due to insufficient evidence of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of depraved mind, and the trial court's abuse of discretion in allowing the state's cumulative and misleading dismemberment presentation. Exploitation of the dismemberment fact, unrelated to the cause of death or the conduct causing or resulting in death, by way of both pictures and testimony, violated Stephen Falkenberg's constitutional right to a fair trial. Additionally, but in the alternative, the open-ended, non-specific, and procedurally circular restitution order imposed at sentencing violates South Dakota law regarding separation of powers and both state and federal due process doctrine. The restitution order should be vacated and remanded to conform to SDCL Section 23A28(3). The repetitive testimony and evidence regarding dismemberment runs afoul of South Dakota's relevancy rules. SDCL Section 1919-401 provides that evidence is relevant if it's more or less probable than without that evidence, as well as a fact of in determining the action. Even if dismemberment is relevant under this concealment illustrating consciousness of guilt, relevancy in South Dakota has its limits, as explained by 1919-403. One witness could have testified to the state LaFrambois's body was found in, giving the state the foundation to make their concealment argument. But instead, the state raised and discussed the dismemberment issue with five different state witnesses: Gregory Thornton Westby, Detective Jeff Brunel, Sebastian Falkenberg, Marissa Luchin, and forensic pathologist Dr. Adam Kovach. But in addition to just the testimony, the state also admitted 10 photos of Tamara LaFrambois's nude body and torso, with specific attention drawn using a laser pointer to the missing extremities and the cut marks. And we're not talking about the good old days when a picture was handed to a jury and passed around. When these pictures were published, it was published up on a giant screen. Pictures so gruesome that before they were published, the trial court judge issued a warning to the spectators, giving them the option to whether they wanted to witness such pictures. The state then also addressed the dismemberment at length in both opening and its closing argument. In its brief on page 23, the state all but concedes that those witnesses testified for the same reason, concealment. This repetition can best be described as needlessly presenting cumulative evidence and confusing the issues, misleading the jury, all of which standing alone warrants exclusion, but standing together even more so.
Forgive me, Ms. Hanson. Is that the argument? Is the argument that it should have been wholesale excluded, or that there should have been an exercise, in your view, a more careful exercise of discretion to limit or to restrict the evidence relating to dismemberment? Because it seems to me that it's part of the case in some form or fashion. So can you help me understand whether it's true exclusion for all of it, for all witnesses, or whether your argument is that the court just allowed too much of it?
Without conceding relevance, because I'm not going to concede that it's relevant to the action in and of itself, but for purposes of the appeal and recognizing the standard that Mr. Falkenberg must reach to receive a new trial, the bigger issue is the amount that came in, that it continued to come in. Not just that it came in once, but that it came in repeatedly, each time elevating the level of abuse of discretion being exercised by the court. So yes, it would be our position that the admission alone was too much, but the better and the stronger argument for abuse of discretion is that it was just this carte blanche presentation, that there was no limitation placed on it, that as soon as the trial court allowed its admission, it allowed all of that to come in, and each time making it a grosser and grosser error in violation of our
time. Well, it seems like it would be difficult to have a trial and have factual testimony about what happened, including how the victim's body was found and how the forensic pathologist conducted the autopsy and that doctor's findings, without describing factually what state the body was in. So it seems like, you don't have to concede, but it seems like it's kind of part of this case.
Without conceding the relevance, it still goes to the substance and the volume of the dismemberment evidence that's coming in. And I understand the court's point completely. And yes, I can understand that it is a part of the case for explanatory purposes, how the body was found. But the state didn't need multiple witnesses to testify to the fact that her body was found in dismembered condition. I'd submit that dismemberment is quite self-explanatory, especially when it's completely unrelated to cause of death. It's purely the observation of the body. But additionally, it's how the dismemberment evidence came in, how the state chose to present it. Two of the witnesses that testify about dismemberment were Marissa Luchin and Sebastian Falkenberg. Both of them met with the state repeatedly about what their testimony was going to be. And the state knew going into trial that Sebastian Falkenberg didn't have any specific knowledge about the dismemberment facts. They knew that Marissa Luchin was going to say that he may have said something along dismemberment as it applies to identity. Transcripts of that are in the court's possession, but also within the appellant's brief. But the state, instead of just asking about a dismemberment fact in passing, or asking, did he tell you anything to Sebastian? They break it down piece by piece, exploiting the fact that Sebastian Falkenberg doesn't have any real evidence or details about this dismemberment fact, but allowing to still repeatedly say this before the jury and using that emotional, visceral language. So it isn't just that it came in, but how they chose to bring it in repeatedly, thanks to the trial court's allowance of them doing so.
But isn't that really better argument that's made to the trial court? I mean, assuming the evidence is relevant, and I know you're not necessarily conceding that, once you get to that point, isn't it really the trial court that's going to decide how much of this should come in and to what extent? I mean, how do we as an appellate court step in and say, oh, that's an abuse of discretion? You shouldn't have allowed that witness, or you shouldn't have allowed that photo. To what extent should we be involved in that? Your arguments are good, but those sound like arguments that should be made to a trial court rather than an appellate court.
And those arguments were made to the trial court. They were argued in October of 2019. And why it becomes relevant for this court to consider under abuse of discretion actually goes back to that specific hearing. When the defense filed a motion to exclude dismemberment, it was to exclude it in its entirety. It was set for hearing October 28th of 2019. And the arguments I'm making today were made to the trial court at that point in time, both the relevance as well as the concerns about it confusing the issues, misleading the jury, and being unduly prejudicial to our client. At that point in time, the court and the state engaged in a back and forth about why the state wanted it in. And I direct the court's attention to page 7, starting at line 11, where the court asked, specific to the dismemberment, "So are you agreeing or disagreeing that it goes only to the issue of concealment and not to intent or motive?" And the state responded, "I think it should go to intent as well as concealment." The court, "So how does it go to intent, to committing the what you've described as the striking that caused her to hit the wall?" The state, "It demonstrated and illustrates the extreme levels or the extensive measures that he would take in order to conceal the crime." The court, "Well, but I understand that. That just gets us back to the issue of concealment. How does it get to the initial issue of intent to commit the crime of murder or manslaughter?" And the state responded, "It would illustrate, Your Honor, and show that he didn't view her as a person." At that point, the court ruled that dismemberment was now going to be allowable. Why this is critical to your abuse of discretion analysis is that the court knew why the state wanted it in. They wanted it in for intent purposes, even though the state also admitted that it was postmortem days later in a separate jurisdiction. But even knowing that, they still wanted to be able to use it for intent, for depraved mind. And the court pushed back. But then the court decides otherwise. So the court's knowledge and the state's candor in why they wanted it in has to be part of that abuse of discretion. The court knew that the state wanted it for intent purposes and would therefore be relying heavily upon it in order to satisfy their burden under the second-degree murder statute.
Why doesn't it apply to intent?
The concealment or the dismemberment?
Yes. And this is also probably lead into your argument as to sufficiency of the evidence as to the depraved mind. Part of that looks at a domestic type relationship and a disregard for another life. So why couldn't this address both in this situation to give us some insight on how he viewed her as a person?
I'm going to answer your question in pieces, Your Honor. So here we have a dismemberment that occurs indisputably days later, post-mortem, and is unrelated to cause of death. It's an action that happens after death, and there's an extensive passage of time. By utilizing that act, you're essentially asking the jury or allowing the jury to look at something that happened unrelated to the conduct causing death and say, well, if somebody could do that then, they must have had a depraved mind at that point in time. That runs afoul of jury instructions and general second-degree murder requirements, that it has to be conduct evincing a depraved mind at the time that it's committed. Now, when you start asking about domestic relationships, recognizing that Stephen Falkenberg and Ms. LaFrambois were in a relationship, I can completely appreciate where the court is going. Because in the past, you see instances of domestic violence that are being admitted into a jury trial to help form that intent. However, there's none of that here. We don't have anything pre-death that would fall under a 404B or some sort of continuation leading up to somebody's demise. We have something that is days later, post-mortem, and unrelated to cause of death. You should not, under our laws, be able to extrapolate that back to create the intent.
Well, and I'm thinking, you know, it appeared that there was some notion that the defendant was attempting to raise sort of a self-defense claim, this notion that she may have had a bat that came in through the discussion with the children. And so we often, and in other cases, look at evidence of concealment or actions after the fact, which have some relevance and bearing as to whether this was really that type of scenario, if you acted in that manner to conceal what you did. And then we also have the issue, well, just stop there. So how is this different than that type of scenario? those types of cases that address concealment actions to be relevant to give insight on what happened in the actual event itself.
In those cases, specifically those that are noted in the state's appellee brief, we're talking about concealment that, or we're talking about dismemberment in their cases that happen close in time with the act itself. In other cases, we're looking at concealment close in time with the act itself. Again, coming to concealment is one thing, but we're talking about an extensive passage of time when it comes to the dismemberment that's now being allowed in for concealment purposes. It's that extension of time that makes this different. It's not a contemporaneous act. It's speaking to the state of mind of someone days later at a minimum, not within that very moment.
Is your argument, your evidentiary argument, I'm transitioning now to your sort of your sufficiency argument, does it depend upon the rules for depraved mind? There's a little bit, as you know, in the briefs of a disagreement you cite in the principal brief, the Reed case. The state disputes that that really has the rule that we apply to depraved mind. Do you need to win on having a Reed type, which, by the way, I didn't see an instruction on a Reed type sort of depraved definition or one proposed. If I'm wrong, please let me know. Do you need to win on that? Do you need to win on a Reed, New Mexico style depraved mind definition in terms of the rule that we apply in order to win on your evidentiary?
No. No, we do not, Your Honor.
Do you win on the rules, or is there a disagreement about what the rules are? Because our Hart case says, you know, you just have to act without regard to it. The Reed case seems to say something different.
No, I mean, the Reed case is more...
It may or may not. I don't know.
Our case doesn't rise or fall on Reed at all. I would instead point the court's attention to the jury instructions, specific final jury instruction number 12 and number 13, two of which have been consistently upheld by this court, clarifying and defining what is evincing a depraved mind, what the court is, or what the jury, rather, is to be looking at. So in final jury instruction number 12, it provides that evincing a depraved mind, regardless of human life, means conduct demonstrating an indifference to the life of others that is not only disregard for the safety of another, but a lack of regard for the life of another. Then in 13, which is to be read together, provides whether the conduct is imminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind, regardless of human life, is to be determined from the conduct itself and the circumstances of its commission. So our case rises and falls on that and the dismemberment argument. The dismemberment isn't contemporaneous with the death of Tamara Lafron Boyce. That conduct, the dismemberment conduct, should not be applied to the death itself, the passage of time, post-mortem, and days later in a separate jurisdiction. But I would also point out, or another way to illustrate this would be to look at prior second-degree murder cases. Recently, in 2020, this court issued the Harif opinion, in which the court confirmed that in order to successfully prosecute a suspect for murder under the second-degree murder statute, the prosecution must prove that the defendant's conduct established that he was acting with a depraved mind. In Harif, this court confirmed that the evincing a depraved mind, the conduct causing or resulting in death that met that element, was the strangulation, the placing of hands on the decedent's neck, the actual conduct that caused or resulted in death. Other second-degree murder cases stand for the same position, that it has to be the conduct causing or resulting in death.
So, counsel, here we have a small, petite woman. We have a construction worker described as his child as having a powerful frame, 6 foot tall. We have a blow admitted by the defendant, similar to perhaps the mule kick referenced in the roof that the victim there experienced. Wouldn't that not constitute a depraved act? We also have a missing head and a fighter's fracture on the hand of the defendant, on the right hand. So would not a single blow constitute an act of depravity?
I would submit no, Your Honor, that that wouldn't be sufficient to make that depraved mind finding, that we're still needing more. Additionally, when you're talking about the evidence in this case, it's important that you look at all of the evidence and recognize how much the dismemberment played in coloring all that evidence. But beyond that, when you mentioned that our client admitted to pushing her, there is not an admission or confession at all by my client. There are statements made by the kids where they say, my dad said this or my dad said that. But when you read the jury transcript in its entirety, which you should in looking at what they say, is they admit that their dad only said this or that, and they themselves met beforehand and talked, trying to make sense of what was going on and created their own assumptions and guesses. Met with their dad briefly, and then again, Marissa Luchin and Sebastian Falkenberg talked again to fill in the gaps. And so both of them were very honest with the jury and with the court that a lot of what they had to say was a guess.
Counsel, I don't want you to waive the question regarding restitution. On the restitution, we don't have your clock here, so it looks the yellow light's on. So with reference to restitution, are you challenging the cost of prosecution of $29,000 and the $2,000-some dollars paid to Sidney Cedillo, or are you just challenging the $15,000 and the $40,000 ordered by the court, the $15,000 to victims' comp fund, the $40,000 to the three family members of the victim?
We're challenging that $15,000 ordered, up to $15,000 to be paid to the Crime Victims Fund, and the up to $40,000 made available to Ms. LaFrambois's family. And we're challenging that because it does not comply with the requirements of SDCL 23-283, requiring a restitution order to be for a specific amount to be paid to a specific person, as well as arguments regarding due process. There's no lack of finality here, as well as separation powers.
Ms. Wentzel, you may proceed on behalf of the state.
May it please the court, counsel. Excuse me. We are here today to talk about the murder of Tammy LaFrambois. The defendant, Stephen Falkenberg, and Tammy were in a romantic relationship. In March of 2019, defendant picked Tammy up from work at 2 a.m. and dropped her off at her apartment. Defendant then returned to her apartment later that morning, saw that she was dressed up, and accused her of cheating with another man. An argument ensued, and defendant shoved Tammy against the wall and punched her in the face so hard that he fractured his hand in two places. Defendant's injury is also known as a boxer's fracture or a fighter's fracture, and it occurs when a person strikes a solid object with a clenched fist. Now, because of the narrowness of defendant's injury, affecting only his middle and ring finger metacarpals, his injury was most consistent with a strike to the chin, cheekbone, or eye socket. Defendant knew Tammy was dead, and he immediately began an elaborate scheme to conceal his crime. On the same day that he killed her, defendant loaded Tammy's body up in his pickup, and headed out of town. He drove 600 miles in a blizzard to his family's farm in Michigan, where he cut off Tammy's head, hands, and feet. He then disposed of her clothes, her body parts, and the tools that he used to dismember her. When defendant was asked about Tammy's whereabouts, he said he didn't know where she was. He lied to his own family and friends. He lied to her family, who was worried. And he lied to law enforcement, who was looking into her disappearance. Defendant shifted the focus, or tried to shift the focus, by telling law enforcement that Tammy was seeing another man before she disappeared. He even lied about how he injured his hand, first saying that he was punching icicles, and then saying that he fell on the ice. On March 16th, two teenagers in Michigan found Tammy's dismembered body, floating in a creek in a rural and wooded area less than 2 miles from defendant's family farm. Due to the condition of Tammy's remains, which did not include her head, hands, or feet, law enforcement in Michigan used descriptions of her tattoos to identify her. To this day, Tammy's missing body parts have not been recovered. Now, on the evening of 16th, after finding out that Tammy's remains had been discovered, defendant asked to reach out to his children and asked to meet. During this meeting, he told him of his fight with Tammy and that he knew she was dead after he shoved her. When his daughter mentioned self-defense, only then did defendant bring up a claim of a bat or claim that Tammy grabbed a bat. And when his daughter asked him about the cutting situation, defendant replied her identity and said that his tools were gone. 2 days later, he was arrested and charged with Tammy's murder. And at his trial, the jury found him guilty of second-degree murder. Now, the state challenges the sufficiency of the evidence. This court reviews a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence in a light most favorable to the jury verdict. And as defense said, they only challenged the depraved mind element of second-degree murder. The state was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant caused Tammy's death by an act imminently dangerous to others, evincing a depraved mind and without regard for human life. The jury was properly instructed that they can consider the conduct itself, the circumstances of its crime, or circumstances of the commission, and the domestic or confidential relationship that existed between Tammy and the defendant. And here,
hearing the argument from Ms. Hansman correctly, it's that rule right there, the circumstances of the commission, which figures, to my hearing anyway, prominently into her argument, Ms. Wenzel, the idea that the circumstances of the commission don't include things that happen at a later point in time. So to that argument, how do you respond?
In this case, the evidence was not used, the dismemberment evidence was not used to prove defendant's depraved mind. The evidence was used to show his consciousness of guilt and to negate his claim of self-defense, but that supports the guilty verdict that doesn't necessarily go to intent. And the
was there any sort of a limitation on how the jury could use this evidence that the court included as an instruction?
Yes, there was a limiting instruction regarding the use of the dismemberment evidence. The jury was instructed that it did not create a presumption of guilt, and the jury could decide whether they wanted to consider the evidence, and that it could only be used as a circumstance to tend to prove the defendant's guilt. And that is its proper.
Was that concealment or dismemberment?
I believe it covered both the concealment. I have it handy. Concealment by the defendant, and then it did talk about dismemberment as well. Concealment by the defendant does not create a presumption of guilt. If you find that the defendant dismembered the body of Tamara LaFambrice or disposed of his tools, then the jury could consider that as tending to prove his consciousness of guilt.
Isn't dismemberment part of the concealment in this case? When we talk about the head itself and your description of the evidence supporting that there was a blow to the head?
Yes, the dismemberment and the concealment evidence do both go to the consciousness of guilt. They both go to defendant's attempts to conceal the crime, conceal the victim's identity, and to conceal her injuries. But that's not the only reason that this evidence was used. It did go to the consciousness of guilt. That is one of the reasons that it was used. But it was also used to prove the elements of the crime. And the trial court when the trial court denied defendant's motion to exclude, they found that the evidence was relevant to the issue of concealment and the elements of the crime, and that was used. And when I say the elements of the crime, I want to be specific. I do not mean the mens rea or the second or the depraved mind element. It actually goes to the first element and then partially to the third. But with regard to depraved mind, here the defendant's actions are what demonstrate his lack of regard for Tammy's life. He's tall. He's physically fit. Tammy's much smaller than him. The jury heard about their volatile relationship. On the day of her death, defendant went to Tammy's apartment and accused her of cheating. He became enraged, and he shoved her into the wall. Then he hit Tammy, the woman that he claimed to love, in the face so hard that he broke his hand. According to defendant's own statements, Tammy died as a result of his actions. Justice Kern, you brought up Steve B. Hariff, and I think that's a really good comparison case here. In that case, that was another second-degree murder charge. The defendant or second-degree murder charge that resulted from an argument between domestic partners. And there, the court concluded that defendant, who was much bigger than his girlfriend, evinced a lack of regard for her life when he admitted to striking her in the chest with the force of a mule kick. That was good enough. That was enough to show his lack of regard for her life. This court in Libel has said if a defendant can act with the lack of regard for human life, he can be found guilty of murder. And here, that's exactly what second-degree murder. And here, that's exactly what the defendant did. And that's what the state used. And a review of the record will show that's what the state used to rely on or relied on in proving defendant's depraved mind. Now, as we've alluded to, defendant does challenge the state's use of concealment and dismemberment evidence. As I said, the trial court let it in, found that it was relevant, and defendant asked for a limiting instruction, and I do think that's important, and thank you, Justice Halter, for bringing that up, too. Defendant asked for a limiting instruction, and he got it. He was given that limiting instruction, and this court assumes or presumes that juries follow those instructions. Now, this court also reviews the court's evidentiary ruling for an abuse of discretion. That's a fundamental error of judgment, a choice outside the range of permissible choices. And on appeal, defendant has the burden of proving that there was an error. And the defendant also has the burden of proving that the error was unfairly prejudicial. Now, when presenting evidence, the state is allowed to admit evidence that is so blended or connected that it explains the circumstances or tends logically to prove the elements of the charged crime. And that's what we have here with regard to the dismemberment and concealment evidence. It was a continuing course of conduct. Immediately after killing Tammy, defendant loaded her up in his pickup and started on his drive. And he continued to take her away to a place where he felt comfortable disposing of her body and where he would feel comfortable that her identity wouldn't be found. So for the first element of the crime, the state was required to prove that defendant killed Tammy. When Tammy's remains were found, she did not have any identifying features, her head or her hands. So the state offered 7 autopsy photos of her tattoos, and these matched her mother's and her kids' testimony about her tattoos. The state also had to prove that her death was a homicide. Now, defendant argues that the dismemberment was not relevant to the cause of death, and that's not true. The state's forensic expert used the autopsy photos and the condition of Tammy's body and the location that she was found to determine cause of death. And he determined the cause of death to be homicide by unspecified means. And he went on to explain that there was no other evidence on the remains that he had that showed cause of death or that alluded to cause of death. And he pointed out that he couldn't rule out other causes or trauma because of the missing parts, namely her head. And importantly, defense's expert came to the same conclusion. Looking at this evidence, he came to the same conclusion that this was homicide by unspecified means. And cause of death was a materially disputed fact. The defense theory was that Tammy overdosed or that it was an accident due to self-defense. And the state is allowed to respond to that. They're allowed to respond to the defense's theory. And finally, the state, for the first element, had to prove that defendant killed Tammy. Now, defendant admitted that he caused Tammy's death and dismembered her and disposed of his tools. To corroborate that admission, the state offered evidence of his hand injury, which arose on the day that Tammy died and disappeared. Tammy's remains were found 2 miles from his family's farm, or family's property in Michigan, 600 miles away from where she was last seen. Her clothes were found in a nearby dump ground. Numerous witnesses placed defendant in Michigan after Tammy disappeared and before she was found. The state offered pictures of tool marks on the amputation sites to show that defendant, a contractor, had both the means and the skill to make those cuts. Connecting defendant to the dismemberment identified him or helped to identify him as the killer. The killer is the one with the motive to dismember the body, to hide her identity, to drive her 600 miles to his family's farm, where he disposed of her body. And that takes me to the next point. It's well settled that a defendant's actions after committing a crime, including his concealment evidence, or concealing the evidence of that crime, is admissible to show his consciousness of guilt and negate his claim of self-defense. Here, defendant claims self-defense, and the state was required to disprove that theory. Defendant said Tammy was violent, but witnesses said that he ignored her. he ignored her when she was physical towards him and was unaffected by her blows. Defendant argued that Tammy grabbed a bat, but there was no evidence of a bat, and his injury was not consistent with defensive wounds from a bat. Defendant was physically fit, and Tammy was very small. She didn't stand a chance against him once he became enraged. And the jury heard defendant's various lies. They heard him joke about his celebrity status after he was arrested and in jail. The defendant's actions after killing Tammy were not due to a brain injury, and it was not self-defense. If Tammy died from an overdose or an accident, defendant would have called the police. He would have helped her. Instead, he went to great lengths to conceal Tammy's identity and injuries because he knew what he did was wrong. His actions in this case support the guilty verdict. Excuse me. A defendant is not entitled to a trial based on sanitized facts, and the state is not required to leave out relevant evidence of defendant's actions because he thinks they're too awful for the jury to hear.
Can you turn to the restitution question, counsel? Did the court's order for restitution for $15,000, in essence, a cap of up to $15,000 to reimburse the victim's compensation fund, and then a cap of up to $40,000 for the three relatives of the victim to be paid as bills accrue and are then presented, does this comply with the requirements of 23A28.3?
Yes, Justice Kern, it does. 23A28.3 defines a plan of restitution. The plan of restitution includes two parts. First, you have the name of the victim and the specific amount owed to the victim. The second part is a schedule of restitution payments. The statute also contemplates two different situations, one where the defendant is sent to prison and one where he is not. Here, when the defendant is sent to prison, the court has the responsibility to set the names and amounts of restitution in the judgment, the restitution owed in the judgment. And the DOC has the responsibility to collect or schedule the collections of the court-ordered restitution. Here, the court ordered certain amounts to be due and certain amounts to be owed pending, like you said, the bills to be offered.
Do you agree with the proposition that that statute, the Dash 3 statute, allows restitution to include pecuniary damages? It actually doesn't say that. It says the defendant can say there are no pecuniary damages, but maybe from that you could infer, maybe you do, maybe you don't, you could infer that that's the kind of damages that the legislature is talking about in that statute. Are you okay with that? Pecuniary damages, that's what we're talking about with restitution?
I think that's a fair reading that...
Let me before you really commit, then let me tell you where I'm going exactly. Pecuniary damages is defined in the Dash 2 statute, and it's defined as damages which a victim could recover against the defendant in civil action, arising out of the same facts or events. And the argument from Mr. Falkenberg is that, as I understand it, maybe that's true on general principles, but there just wasn't any proof. And so if we're examining, the extent to which maybe you could get future damages, maybe you could do those sorts of pecuniary damages are contemplated, perhaps. But and even at sentencing, where there's relaxed evidentiary standards, there's relaxed proof standards, really, under a reasonable satisfied standard, you still have to have something, don't you? I mean, can you just say, I'm gonna identify this amount, and you know that'll be the amount, and future bills can be, offset against that or applied to that? Doesn't there have to be some sort of proof?
There does. There does need to be proof, and I would like to. If you go back to the court's order, she ordered certain funds or certain costs to be due. The cost of restitution and around $2,100 to the defendant.
Cost of prosecution.
Yes, cost of prosecution, excuse me, and around $2,100 to be due to Tamara's daughter. Those are due. She said those are not subject to further hearing. Then she offered defendant an idea of what he would be subject to, and that is important. And she said that the state is still required to offer bills proving those costs, and then if the defendant objected, he could request a hearing. So those costs are not...
2 minutes.
Those costs are not yet due.
Under what authority in our statutory scheme or otherwise can the court do that?
The court has broad discretion in imposing restitution. So I want to start there. There's nothing in our statutory law that limits the court's ability to write the restitution order the way the court did in this context. There's nothing that limits the court's jurisdiction with regard to restitution, and this court's...
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think that the court's authority to act is limited very much by the enactments of the legislature and the Constitution. And although circuit courts, as you know, are courts of general jurisdiction, they're not courts of unlimited jurisdiction, surely.
Right, but for a comparison, the court's jurisdiction, for instance, to revoke a sentence, is limited to 2 years under SDCL 23A, 27, and 19. But as this court has said, that statute has nothing to do with restitution.
Enforcement of restitution. But how about ordering ongoing amounts after the 2 years? I mean, we're talking about potentially hearings 4 years, 5 years down the road to deal with incoming counseling costs that are being incurred as time passes. Now, does that conflict with the requirement of the statute 23A283 that requires the specific amount of restitution to be levied at the time of sentencing? That's what's concerning me.
Right, and it does not conflict with that because restitution, first of all, acts as an independent judgment to any other sentence. So I do think it's different more than just for purposes of enforcing. Restitution is different. And there's no conflict with 23A283. It just says that the court has to, it's court-ordered restitution. That's what it talks about. The court has to say what is owed, not necessarily what is due. And so I don't believe the court would be limited by that statute. And
your time is up, Ms. Wenzel.
Thank you.
Sandsman, you may proceed with rebuttal argument for 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. A moment ago, the state made a statement in regards to restitution that the court's order gave the defendant an idea of what he was owed. An idea is not constitutionally enough. Due process attaches at the time of sentencing, and Holzing provides further explanation of this, but to be succinct at this point in time, Stephen Falkenberg had a constitutional right at the time of sentencing to be told what he owed under restitution. Not what he might owe, not what he could owe, but what he owed at that point in time. That's the moment when due process attached. This idea that simply saying, well, he could contest it later, this is just an idea of what it could be, isn't enough.
Ms. Hansman, do you need to, two questions. One on the separation of powers issue, and then if I could, I'd like to ask you about relief and what you envision in terms of relief. But first on the separation of powers question, similar to the one that I asked you earlier in your argument on a different issue, do you need to win? Do you need to win on your separation of powers argument, or is it sufficient to prevail if you just win on the general argument that the court didn't have authority to do what the court did? You need to win on that separation of powers argument, or can you win on just an application of the statutes?
We win on application of statute.
Second question. What in your earlier comments at the outset, you said, I might not have jotted it down correctly, but something along these lines, on the restitution order, you're seeking a remand, and the verb you used was to conform. Conform to the rules of law or something like that. So is your idea of relief that if you prevail on that, that this court vacates the restitution order and it goes back down without the 15 and the 40 and you're done? Or does it go back down for some additional proceeding relative to the issue of restitution on those issues.
When I ask for it to be vacated and remanded to conform to 23A-28-3, I'm asking the court to strike that $15,000 and the $40,000 in the current order and limit the order simply to that $2,191.55, a specific amount ordered to Sidney Cedillo, a specific individual.
I understand your argument. You're not envisioning additional proceedings in the circuit court relative to restitution, only the issuance of a new judgment that would include just those two amounts.
Correct. And I can understand if there is possibly a hesitation about that because it is an emotionally charged case. One thing I would point out is this issue becomes moot when a retrial happens for Mr. Falkenberg. But second, I want to touch on something that I believe either Justice Salter or Justice Kern might have brought up, which was the pecuniary damage. Is sending or vacating this order to conform to statute does not foreclose Tamara LaFrambois's family from further compensation. They still have the complete use of the civil system to seek further compensation if they deem it necessary. This is not their only opportunity or avenue for compensation. Changing the order, forcing it to conform to SDCL 23A-28-3 for that $2,100 would simply make that a set-off from later proceedings.
Were there sums already received by the victim's compensation fund that had not been brought forth to the court? I mean, when I look at that sentencing hearing transcript, it sounds like there were 18 counseling visits and other sums that were already being compensated and reviewed by the victim's comp fund. And so those would have been in the hopper, so to speak. And receipts were supposed to be provided, the court said, to your client, to counsel. Were those resolved? We can't tell from the record. Because you're saying that there should be no further compensation if it's remanded back.
Correct. So there wasn't the documentation. Even the court admitted that the documentation provided by the state at the time of sentencing and restitution was deficient. It was lacking. And that's why the court then set these amounts and said, well, you can just come back and contest that at another point in time. That was the inappropriate way to have handled things. And because of that, we are asking that those amounts, those just up for grabs amounts, so to speak, Your Honor, that those be struck and the only amount as restitution be the amount that was ordered at that point in time to comply with due process and statute.
Is there a problem with the finality of the court's judgment if you have to have a series of continuing restitution hearings even beyond the court's two-year jurisdictional?
Absolutely. Hearing? This idea that, well, he can simply come back and contest those amounts sets into motion this hamster wheel of continuing litigation. Anytime there is an amount sought for reimbursement under the current order, it's going to require counsel for defendant Stephen Falkenberg to file a written response, and the state would get to respond. Then it would be set for a hearing. Both counsel from the Attorney General's office and Falkenberg's counsel both would need to be in attendance, as would Mr. Falkenberg personally, because he has the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, even for a restitution hearing. So now we're transporting somebody from either the South Dakota State Penitentiary or wherever he's being held. We have a full evidentiary hearing. That's going to require those witnesses to be brought before the court to be cross-examined and to explain the amounts being sought. Those witnesses are primarily out of state. So now we're probably adding expenses that are then going to be put into this hamster wheel. After the evidence is received by the court is going to issue an order. Either side will have the right to appeal that order, filing a notice of appeal, seeking those transcripts, briefing the issue, and then sending it up to this court to decide whether it's something that requires oral argument like we're embarking on today or can be decided on the non-oral calendar, and then we wait for a decision. If it's reversed, we start back over just on that one submission, keeping in mind that multiple other submissions are being contested along the way and are in the queue.
So what, I'm sorry, I don't want you to run out of time, but Is there something in the middle of that? So instead of looking at this as a piecemeal, bill by bill sort of determination, if we look at the record now and determine that there wasn't sufficient evidence before the court to order this $15,000 amount and a $40,000 amount, But yet there was evidence or something submitted in the record that suggests there are, maybe either as Justice Kern referenced, other currently existing bills that haven't been submitted yet, or a evidence that would show that there is a counseling similar expense that's going to incur. What is the legal reason why a remand couldn't go back for one hearing to address what is the evidence before the court at this time that would support a specific number, whether it be if we find inadequate findings to support these numbers? Is there a legal reason why that could not be a remedy? But then still required a definite number to be set at that remand hearing.
There isn't something I can point the court to that says you have to simply strike it and use only the amount in the present order that conforms to statute, and that's what should control. I don't have...
2 minutes, counsel.
Other than perhaps the idea that we're having this appeal and we're talking about this issue and we're deciding it now.
Correct, and that's where I was actually going, Your Honor, so thank you for very articulately adding to my argument. So other than that, no. But this is the place and time for it to be discussed, and that would be the remedy that Mr. Falkenberg is seeking. Seeing that my time is quickly coming to a close, Your Honor, I would remind the court that the bigger issue here today is the abuse of discretion by the trial court in allowing this unbridled presentation of dismemberment evidence. Evidence that was not related to cause of death and occurred post-mortem days later in a separate jurisdiction. Evidence that is so quickly and intrinsically intertwined with all other evidence that it poisoned the entirety of the trial. Based upon those reasons, as well as the arguments articulated in the brief, Stephen Falkenberg respectfully requests that this court reverse and remand his case for a new trial. Not because he deserves a perfect trial, Your Honor, but because Stephen Falkenberg deserves and is entitled to that which every South Dakota citizen is entitled to, and that's a fair trial.
All right, thank you for the arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.